the TV while thinking about surf magazines fighting over Instagram. And cocaine. The new miracle was infused into beverages, solutions, tonics. A popular early iteration was the coca wine. Coca leaves are purified cocaine distilled in red wine. Abraham Lincoln paid 50 cents for a bottle of cocaine in 1860, becoming the first person in the United States, apparently, to partake. Ulysses S. Grant was diagnosed with throat cancer and fed cocaine by none other than Mark Twain, who was trying to ease his pain and keep him alive long enough to steal his memories, fractured as they might be, for a book on America's Civil War. Jules Verne drank so much coca wine while writing 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea that he felt he was going to live forever. And Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, creator of Sherlock Holmes, had the world's most famous detective use cocaine in order to escape from the dull routine of existence. Coca-Cola, and its later grocer Diet Coke, made the scientific wonder an American brand. Before it was called Coca-Cola, it was called Peruvian Wine Cola. The only remnant of Peru that remains in our modern Coca-Cola and its bastard Diet Coca-Cola is its red and white motif, a nod toward Peru's flag. In 1900, pure cocaine was selling in the United States of America for 25 cents a gram and could be purchased in any store without a prescription, any pharmacy. According to Professor of History of Medicine at Yale University, David F. Musto, in his Scientific American story titled Opium, Cocaine, and Marijuana in American History, Park Davis, one of America's oldest drug makers, sold cocaine by telling customers that it can supply the place of food, make the coward brave, the silent eloquent, and render the sufferer insensitive to pain. Apparently forgetting to note that it can also render the sufferer insensitive to self-modulation or reflection, and also give the sufferer an ability to solve complex international crises in a single conversation. It truly was a gilded age, with Americans turning out and turning on. The earliest jazz danced on a bold, toxic, industrialized wind. Cocaine was literally everywhere, and surfing had just been dubbed the sport of kings by none other than turn-of-the-century celebrity Jack London. The author of survivalist classics Call of the Wild and White Fang had become famous for his gorgeously descriptive novels, but also for his outsized personality and adventurous spirit. In 1906, he designed a catch and sailed it from San Francisco to Honolulu. It was there, perched on the grass of the Moana Hotel, that he looked up and suddenly, out there where a big smoker lifts skyward, rising like a sea god out of the welter of spume and churning white, on the giddy, toppling, overhanging and downfalling, precarious crest appears the dark head of a man. Swiftly he rises through the rushing white. His black shoulders, his chest, his loins, his limbs, all is abruptly projected on one's vision, where but the moment before was only the wide desolation and invincible roar, is now a man, erect, full-statured, not struggling frantically in the wild movement, not buried and crushed and buffeted by those mighty monsters, but standing above them all, calm and superb. Like Mark Twain almost 40 years prior, London had to give this strange dance a go. Unlike Twain, he was undaunted with his first rough experience and kept at it with the help of legends Alexander Hume Ford and George Freeth. Hume, a South Carolina transplant who had just moved to the islands and become completely addicted to surfing, watched London struggle in the shore break on a too small board, marched up and told him that he was going to die if he didn't get a longer board. London followed him and Freeth the next day out beyond the shore break to where real waves bounced and fought a battle in which mighty blows were struck on one side and in which cunning was used on the other side, before finally catching a wave and experiencing what he described as ecstatic bliss. And he was hooked, staying out in the water for so long that he became horribly sunburned. But did he care? No. So blistered he could not even move, he sat in bed and wrote, "But tomorrow, ah, tomorrow, I shall be out in that wonderful water, and I shall come in standing up, even as Ford and Freeth. And if I fail tomorrow, I shall do it the next day, or the next. Upon one thing I am resolved. The Snark shall not sail from Honolulu until I, too, wing my heels with the swiftness of the sea, and become a sunburned, skin-peeling Mercury. It's certain that Jack London would have grown his own pterygia had he not been forced back to the mainland. But surfing stayed with him, and his article, A Royal Sport, romanticized surfing for millions of readers enjoying their magazines with a thimbleful of 25-cent cocaine. And then another thimbleful of 25-cent cocaine. And then another thimbleful of 25-cent cocaine. And then another thimbleful of 25-cent cocaine. Or maybe only the doctors and dentists were reading London with coke-addled eyes. This was the first class of people known to take the miracle of cocaine a bit too far, and were dubbed cocainomaniacs by the press, who wrote stories about their degenerate behaviors, which, in turn, caused a drop in national cocaine consumption by up to half. It was not until stories of African Americans' abuses, though, that politicians began to devise ways to curb cocaine production and use. At the time, most of America's cocaine was coming from Peru, up through the Panama Canal and to New Orleans. Journalists began to flood newspapers with tales of wild, coke-fueled fights and insurrections by predominantly African-American dock workers. Tales of attacks on white Southern women being the direct result of a cocaine-crazed Negro brain. And America's first drug czar, Dr. Hamilton Wright, alleged that drugs made African-American men uncontrollable and encouraged them to rebel against white people. Panicked Southerners led to the passage of the United States Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906, which knocked the coca out of Coca-Cola, and then the Harrison Narcotics Tax Act of 1914, which quite basically made cocaine, opium, and future derivatives illegal. Cocaine no longer represented the glamorous perfection of scientific knowledge. It was seen as deviant, as decadent, as a naughty mark on the human soul. And surfing? Surfing was right behind her lover, descending into the realm of depravity, the hole of lusty delight, the pit of sensual despondency. After Jack London had pushed off in his gloriously named Snark and written about the dignified royal pastime, crowds began to throng to Waikiki's perfect sands and wanted all for themselves. The palms, the coconuts, the warmth, and the waves. And a handful of locals who came to be known as beach boys were there to cater to their every whim. Loose, charming, drunk, and drugged, these Peter Pans would show the tourists hula, cook them a luau, and paddle them around in the shadow of Diamond Head, in either canoe or on surfboard. And that is what turned them on. These beach boys were surfers above all, and would surf with tourists and surf without them, too, forming a locals-only club called Huinalu, or in English, Wave Sliders. They were out on every swell, putting on a show for others or just for themselves. Addicted to the big smokers, or as the surf historian Matt Warshaw writes in his History of Surfing, surfing was as important to these barefoot troubadours as their sexed-up, easy-going, empty-pocket deviancy. By combining the two, the Beach Boys laid a foundation for what would later be called the surfing lifestyle. The surfing lifestyle. And I feel my phone buzz in my pocket. I know it's my wife, and I know I should have gone home instead of coming to Duke's and mocking myself. I pull it out, ready to catch hell, but it is not my wife. It's the surf filmmaker I was supposed to meet, and his text reads, "Chaz, so sorry. I totally forgot we have a little premiere thing at the Roosevelt tonight. Come up." My wife is going to kill me. Chapter 6. The Meeting with the Goddess. I plod from Huntington to Hollywood in a standard blur. Stop, go, speed, flip off, make angry face, change lanes. Listen to a new track by ex-One Direction heartthrob Harry Styles. Listen to a new track by Miley Cyrus's younger sister, Noah. I always listen to the worst music when I'm driving and writing. I would try and blame my wife's daughter, and some of it is her fault, but it's mostly mine. My heart beats to teenage girl music. I finally pull into the valet stand at the Roosevelt, which is jammed. I step out of my car to see what's happening and watch a valet who's looking at another valet who's looking at a rented white Jeep Compass who then looks over at me. The front bumper is halfway off and there's a giant dent in the passenger's side door and the whole thing is covered in red mud. But I don't know why the valets care. They didn't do it. And this is the damned Roosevelt, not the Chateau Marmont, for crying out loud. I can't remember how many surf parties I've been to here. Definitely more than 10. Maybe even 20. There's something between the surf industry and the Roosevelt. Some deep and abiding bond. All the brands, from Globe to Volcom to Quicksilver to Billabong. Even small ones like Radnor and Let's Party have thrown something or another here. Movie premieres, product launches, birthday parties, photo exhibitions, promotion fetes, even one celebrating the firing of a team manager. Tonight, the surf industry is celebrating the release of a new surf clip by the surf film director I was supposed to be meeting at Duke's and who's supposed to be promoting a new high-top shoe that may or may not be stylish. When there's no official brand event or party, surfers will stay here if whatever they're attending is within a 20-mile radius, or even 30. I don't know that any other Los Angeles hotel is even considered. I don't even know if surfers know the name of another hotel, but they all know the Roosevelt, and even know how to get here without using Google Maps. It is their true north. Maybe it's Teddy's. The once hot Roosevelt Lobby Club, with its perpetually lusty orange glow and crowds craning necks to see if someone cooler were lurking in neighboring human knots, hosted the best of Hollywood's brightest for a handful of years in the mid-2000s. Meg Ryan, early Paris Hilton, that one guy who wrestled professionally, River Phoenix, Johnny Depp, etc. The club was started by Amanda Shear Demme, widow of Ted Demme, who is in her own right a famous photographer and takes the best celebrity pictures ever, all moody and sexy and dark. She took a picture of Joaquin Phoenix, River's brother, smoking a cigarette and getting punched, which wowed. She also took a picture of Travis Fimmel with his perfect nose and his bluest eyes and fuck him. I'm sorry, that is jealousy writing. Ted, her departed husband, was a popular figure and talented artist in his own right. He directed the best cocaine film ever, starring Johnny Depp. Blow was based on the memoir of George Jung, who helped the Medellin cartel supply 85% of the United States' supply in the 1970s and 1980s. Ted died of a cocaine-induced heart attack in 2002. Amanda made the club in his honor, and now, I suppose, surf and the Roosevelt make perfect sense, a deep and abiding bond, a love affair that hides in the orange glow and the memory of neck-craning knots. I hear the valet ask the Jeep's driver, who I recognize as a professional surfer who rides for RVCA, you guys checking in, or... But he doesn't respond because he's telling his surfer bro, who rides for Rusty, a story about one of his bros who got bottled on the Gold Coast last week. So my mate was out surfing Snapper, I guess, and stuffed this guy pretty good. Anyhow, that night outside the Coolangatta Hotel, he was drinking a beer, and the guy he stuffed came up to him and tried to bottle him, like there on the sidewalk. The Bogan was so drunk, though, that he just swung and ended up hitting a parked car, passed out on the ground. I feel bad for the valets because long ago I used to be one, and I shout to RVCA, "Hey, are you guys staying here?" He looks up and laughs. "Chaz, how's it, mate?" "Yeah, for two nights." The valet stutters slightly and responds, "Do you have a reservation yet? You have to have reservations because we're expecting a full..." The two surfers don't let him finish and walk off giggling and reenacting the bottling without taking their ticket. The two valets are left with an uncomfortable conundrum on their hands and look at me, but I just shrug and walk toward the door, too, without my ticket, wondering how quickly I can leave, and also wondering if there are more bottling incidents among surfers than any other population grouping. I had no idea what a bottling was prior to heading to Australia's Gold Coast over a decade ago. I was covering the first surf contest of the year, the Quicksilver Pro, and at a pub when I saw some drunken surfer grab a beer bottle, smash it on a table, then wave it in the face of another drunken surfer. Viciously. Maniacally. It felt like the Wild West, and I imagined I was witnessing some odd occurrence, but was later told bottlings are so common that the government recently passed a law where glass would not be used after midnight in order to try and curb incidents. Or maybe it's just an Australian surfer thing. I don't recall ever seeing a bottling in... Oh, I take that back. I saw a Brazilian surfer think about bottling a Californian surfer in San Clemente, but he couldn't break the bottle and got tackled to the ground first. Fucking surfers. And I hate drinking out of plastic, but I think it's all they use at the Roosevelt, and I should probably be happy. Inside, brand managers, team managers, executive vice presidents, and professional surfers are mingling with an odd assortment of young professionals and computer programmers who think the Roosevelt is still a place to be and accidentally got caught in the surf industry's maw. A giant movie screen is stretched out over the shallow end of the pool and is flickering with images from a pool party. Bikini-clad girls jumping onto giant blow-up donuts in slow motion and splashing each other. A display case featuring the high tops has been set up near the deep end. I wander over to it and study, but still can't tell if they're any good. If the toe is right, if the height is appropriate... If the materials match the ethos of... I can't tell what the ethos is supposed to be. Brooklyn hipster meets Bondi hipster, or maybe Byron hipster? And is the surfer supposed to wear them at the Roosevelt? Jazz, a voice says behind me in classic upper register vowel extended surf drawl, interrupting my surf journalism. I turn around and see a rep for Grapes the Cat, a surf-branded phone charger that began as an invite-only Instagram account featuring naked girls that got shut down. I don't exactly know how the one attaches to the other, narratively, but it clearly doesn't matter. He's tall, with a lantern jaw and jaunty, salty crew hat. "How's it, brah?" he says semi-ironically. "You going to Agenda tomorrow?" Agenda is one of the industry trade shows that happens every year, or maybe two times a year, in Long Beach. "Oh, brah," I respond semi-ironically and tell him, "Shoots." He nods slowly while throwing a semi-ironic shaka. Hawaiian pidgin, from the "how's it" to the "ho" to the "brah" to the "shoots" to the shaka, are such a part of surf culture that they're used semi-ironically by everyone not Hawaiian. Ironically, because making gentle fun of surf and surf culture is the dialect of the industry. Semi, because we are all genuinely shallow and can't figure out another way to communicate. I'm even unsure of some of their real meanings, like "shoots." I don't know if "shoots" means yes or cool, and so I use it interchangeably for both, yet have never been corrected. And while he's throwing his semi-ironic shaka, he accidentally knocks a lower-tier Hollywood writer type's cocktail out of his hand. It bounces off the pool deck, since it is damned plastic. The writer looks down at his polo shirt, which caught some of his cocktail, and then it Grapes the Cat, and then at me. It seems like he's going to say something, but his eyes go wide for one split second before he shakes his head and retreats into the crowd. His wide eyes displayed a touch of fear. Only the smallest touch, but it was still there, and it's a wonder that Surf still retains a whiff of danger, a smell of brawling danger. On the inside, it feels so conservative, so stiff, so Orange County scrubbed, so tight, so paranoid. But when Surf touches real life, it becomes apparent that externally, the perception differs. Young professionals and computer programmers and maybe even lower-tier Hollywood writer types think surfers are unhinged, no goods, bad seeds. And maybe they're right. It was Honolulu's Beach Boys that set the narrative tone in the 1920s with their empty pocket, sexed-up deviancy, and it translated perfectly to Depression-era California. Jobs were scarce already, but surfing had just taken root, and waves didn't cost a dime. Surfers would stay on the beach all day, and some would stay on the beach all night, drinking, lighting fires, surfing, living on what were then the absolute fringes of society. There's a classic story of a 1930s legend named Gene Tarzan Smith, who lived in a cave that he carved out of the sandstone near Orange County's Corona del Mar. He was a drunk and a fighter, and on weekends, he would paddle his surfboard across the Newport Harbor, dance in the Rendezvous Ballroom, get drunk, get in fights, then paddle back to his cave at night. He could paddle so well that he once made it all the way from Oahu to Kauai, a 70-mile journey that took 30 hours. It's said that by the end of it, Tarzan thought he was paddling up Hollywood Boulevard, which makes perfect sense, seeing that the Roosevelt sits at the corner of Hollywood and Orange. Not all surfers were derelicts, of course, but I'll be damned if the general embryonic future surf culture instinct didn't lean heavily toward the black, even if accidentally. Up until the 1930s, for example, if you wanted to surf, you had to carve your own board from a tree. There was no such thing as a commercially produced surfboard. But then the Great Depression happened, and the son of a manufactured home company magnate decided his life was going to be poor hell no matter what he did. So he dropped out of Stanford and convinced his father to let the company let him carve surfboards. He had been to the beaches and seen the future. His father agreed, and in 1932, young Myers Butte started pumping swastika surfboards out of the Pacific Systems Homes warehouse. Yes, swastika. According to The History of Surfing, Butte knew the normal hand-carved 70-pound surfboard was too heavy, so he made wholesale buys on light, kiln-dried balsa wood. The boards had a balsa core and redwood on the sides, nose, and tail. Half-inch strips of redwood or mahogany might also be laid along the board's vertical axis. The laminated, mixed wood designs were nearly as strong as the one-piece hand-carved redwoods, but much lighter. A 10-foot swastika weighed just 45 pounds, and each board, with its contrasting and perfectly interlocked pieces, looked as if it had been pulled from Frank Lloyd Wright's sketch pad. Each was fire-emblazoned with the hook-crossed design, later made famous by Adolf Hitler. A cartoon surfer, who even looked strikingly like Adolf Hitler, was used as swastika's first advertisement. There he stood, proud above the waves, very face forward, very strong bone structure and combed hair, very Leni Riefenstahl, very Aryan, with the shadow of his upper lip forming what looked like a small toothbrush mustache. And even though Nazi Germany wasn't a thing in 1930, surfers are prescient sons of bitches, the future somehow reflecting in the shallow pool of their souls. I refocus on what Grapes the Cat is saying and think it involves how their agenda booth is going to feature some girls who just left Monster Energy and are starting their own modeling thing. I'm going to ask him if anyone has actually ever tried Monster Energy drink and if anyone actually thinks the Monster girls are hot. But I'm interrupted by a kinetic ball of fire asking if either of us know where to get some toot. Toot sounds like it might also be Hawaiian pidgin, but it's actually the favorite Australianism for cocaine. He's drunk enough to be completely unbothered by the stigma of asking directly, and also a filmer, the most sunburned class of the surf industry hierarchy, the most put upon and the least celebrated. They have to sit for hours in the boiling sun, pointing cameras at professional surfers who spin in the distance, and what the hell sort of job is that? I mean, clearly more understandable than surf journalist or surf historian, but neither Matt Warshaw nor I have to sit in the boiling sun. Matt Warshaw doesn't even have the opportunity to see the boiling sun. He lives in Seattle. I tell the filmer that I don't have any toot, and look over at Grapes the Cat, who is stuttering an excuse, but the filmer has already seen a better possible mark and has skipped off toward the pool. The conversation returns to agenda and some rumor swirling about two middle-aged Australians who are buying up surf properties for way more than they're worth. They bought a removable fin company, a wave forecasting website, and a fake version of Beach Grit called Stab. Spending impulsively and wildly, but also fighting a lot, apparently. And while I just told Grapes the Cat shoots when he asked me if I was going to agenda, I was totally lying. Or maybe lying, since I still don't know exactly what it means and how it's used. But now I know that I have to go. Impulsive, wild-fighting Australians? There's only one thing that can mean. Love. And my thread. Chapter 7. Sacred Marriage. I drive to Long Beach early after getting home way too late from Hollywood. Tiredness swells in me. Apathy. I'm so apathetic that when Drake comes on the radio, I don't switch the station, and I hate Drake. Like, hate Drake. Like, really. And now there's a strange cover of Sublime's Santeria bouncing between the cavernous walls of the Long Beach Convention Center. Or maybe it actually is Sublime, and I hate that I actually came to agenda almost as much as I hate Drake. The monster girl standing in front of What Youth's booth is trying to explain to me the mechanics of a t-shirt gun. The high-powered cannon that hype men and women use to rocket tight-neck t-shirts into adoring audiences, and that monster girls use to shoot 10-year-old surf fans in the face during Huntington Beach's U.S. Open of Surfing with fluorescent green garbage. I don't know, you just have to put it in there, and then the pressure builds and it just pops, she says, while making a rubbing up and down motion with her hand. It all reads very sexual here in print, and would theoretically look seductive. But in person, it's not, because have you ever caught a t-shirt from a howitzer, even accidentally? There is, first, a painful realization that stings from hand to elbow, followed quickly by a painful realization, when unfurled, that the t-shirt's neck would choke a very small baby and will definitely choke you no matter how unfashionably you prefer your t-shirts. I've never understood why cannon fodder t-shirt necks have to be so tight. Are they cheaper to produce? Do the market analyses point to trending tight necks? Do tight-necked t-shirts have better aerodynamics when rolled into the shape of a bullet? Or are the Chinese trying to choke a certain percentage of the population to death before a full-scale invasion? I don't know, and the monster girl doesn't care. Her demonstration is over, and her bored, smoky eyes are scanning over my shoulder, taking in the crowd, gauging potential for after-parties, looking for friends, waiting for the minutes to tick by before she's sent packing to Riverside. I wonder how long her shift will be as I untether and drift back into the sea of flannel shirts, beanies, black jeans, and Vans, and shuffle aimlessly. I wonder if she was once excited to be a monster girl, like if that was once her dream. The booths, Billabong, Rip Curl, RVCA, Banks, Brixton, Captain Finn, Deus, Huff, Rusty, the Critical Slide Society, all look like a version of the same thing. Like a tri-colored mural of the 5-year apocalypse, of the dizzying fall. Design that hasn't changed for multiple seasons. Everyone still stuck on anchor motifs and hipster minimalism, except without the attention paid to fit. Glum brand ambassadors filling the odd order for even glummer retailers. Glummer retailers wondering if fortune will ever smile upon them again. If the kids will ever lust for a surf label again. If Zara is hiring. The rumor of the two middle-aged Australians on a surf buying spree is just that. Rumor. They are not here, though I do see a friend who met with one of them last week. He says, oh man, he was so bad. He was wearing bootcut jeans and like had a big watch. The only booth that is noticeably different is Quicksilver's. That brand once threw parties that rivaled the best of Hollywood. Parties in Paris's Grand Palais. Parties that featured waves of bottomless veuve and mountains of caviar and mountains of cocaine, except the cocaine was not expressly supplied, or at least that's how I've heard it told. The smart businessman, though, smells surfers from a mile away, and when surfers are in town, knows to strike with as much product as he can find. For Quicksilver's 40th anniversary Grand Palais party, smart businessmen from as far away as Transylvania were waiting outside with pockets full of gear. But maybe the Transylvanians were simply there because the party featured Tony Hawk, who really and truly looks like the Walking Dead. Quicksilver once rented half of Agenda's trade show floor and filled it with the glitter and hope of their multi-billion dollar valuation. The first brand in all of surf to reach that glorious height. Now, bankruptcy has relegated them to a dark corner where hastily screen-printed t-shirts are staple-gunned to a prefabricated wall. Rubberneckers shuffle past just to take it in, but none make eye contact with the remaining Quicksilver employee, lest whichever brand they work for is next. Lest they are next, staple-gunning the tatters of a once sunny surf career to a prefabricated wall. I shuffle past with the rest of the rubberneckers, except the new surf journalist beat of my cursed heart forces my head up and my eyes forward. To pass and not take it in would be like Woodward and Bernstein refusing to look Nixon directly in his green eye. Like Edward R. Murrow failing to fully examine Joseph McCarthy's motives. Like Megyn Kelly wilting under Donald J. Trump's menacing stare and sexist growl. To turn away from the stink of the time. So I look and take it in. Ready to cringe, but actually liking the retro hot pink cartoon scribble dog saying, "Stay fucking high," in a cartoon bubble on a tattered sweatshirt, also featuring Quicksilver's iconic mountain and wave logo. It feels like they mean it, so there's some genuine angsty pop, and wonder if there would be some amazingly lucid revelation from the remaining Quicksilver employee, some pearl of wisdom only gleaned after fasting 40 days and 40 nights. But I'm neither Woodward, nor Bernstein, nor Murrow, nor Kelly. And I don't feel like talking about a bummer while looking for love, so I shuffle on. Past Nixon, Oakley, O'Neill, Hurley, Body Glove, Visla, DeBlanc, who may not be bankrupt but are also totally and completely uninspired. Surf style has become so concretely uniform, with brand managers turning to trend forecasters in order to stave off death so everything feels the exact same. Anchors and bullshit. Anchors pulling all this bullshit to the ocean's floor. And then I stumble upon the oasis of cynical joy, sitting where a booth should be but didn't get constructed. A surf filmmaker, two professional surfers, and a team manager who have just launched a surf traction company named Octopus. There is absolutely no money in surf traction. No margin, no volume, no nothing. The average surfer probably spends $35 on surf traction a year. No more. Probably less. And no non-surfer touches the stuff. Why would they? To stick weird shapes on walls? To, use it in kinky sex dungeons? But these four started it for exactly that reason. Everyone was so worried about the bottom line and making money, but this is surfing. the surf filmmaker told me right before the launch. It's all totally absurd. We just want to have fun again. It's literally surfing. Can you even think of anything more absurd to monetize? And even in the midst of the 5-year apocalypse with no end in sight, surf still produces rebels, and this thread extends back 4,000 years. From the surfers who start impossible-to-monetize companies to the Peruvian fisherman rebelling against his bleak surroundings by putting his feet up on the handlebars. The Hawaiian king rebelling against the pressure of his plebeian bone-crushing existence by rolling on the waves. To the Hawaiian plebe rebelling against his bone-crushing king by surfing too. To the early pre-war Californian rebelling against taste by paddling in relatively freezing cold water, living in sandstone caves, riding swastikas, to the post-war Californian rebelling by trespassing past Malibu's Keep Out sign while creating the boldest counterpoint to baby boom hegemony and rocking the rest of the modern time. Or at least, rocking the rest of my modern time. Malibu. The word sounds good, it feels good. But it wasn't always good, or at least accessible. It's a Spanish bastardization of the native Chumash, Hamalewu, which means loud waters. There was a small village there where fishermen would push up the river and out to sea. The Spanish co-opted the land from the Chumash and broke it into a 13,300-acre named Rancho Malibu. The Americans co-opted it from the Spanish after the U.S.-Mexican War, with the cocaine fiend Ulysses S. Grant writing the last surviving deed when he granted it to an Irishman named Matthew Keller, who sold the whole plot 35 years later to Frederick Hastings Ringe and his wife May Kay. It was May Kay who tenaciously took on all comers to keep Malibu private. She fought the railroad. She fought the highway commission. She fought the sons of bitches carrying giant wood planks who desired to do unspeakable things to her waves. The very first surfers who rode Malibu, Sam Reed and Tom Blake, had to park their car 2 miles away in 1927 and paddle up the coast. It was, I'm certain, as magnificent then as it is now, but the equipment of the time couldn't quite handle its speed. And May Kay made it a pain in the ass to reach, so it was left alone until Hitler was vanquished and America's boys came streaming home with a taste for blue skies and wide open spaces, with a taste for suburban Southern California. This post-war explosion, its perpetual sun, tabula rasa, potential for anything because nothing really existed before, transformed Los Angeles from a place of Hollywood dreams to an expansive reality, and by the early 1950s, the basin rocketed past Chicago as America's second largest population center. Freeways, cars, palm trees, swimming pools. And while the upstanding new residents went about marrying and booming babies to fill brand new tract homes, the derelicts shook out to a place where they could ply their deviant trade alone. And can you imagine a better name than Loud Waters, than Malibu? It sounds good. It feels good. It feels like a rock and roll version of a Frank Lloyd Wright sculpture. And those Chumash knew everything. And we should never have taken their land and a pox on all our houses, but also Malibu. Former Surfer magazine editor Paul Gross wrote that it is the exact spot on Earth where ancient surfing became modern surfing. But why exactly Malibu? What makes it different from any other spot? It begins with the wave, and I won't go into its mechanics because there's nothing duller than wave mechanics, not even Algebra 2. In short, the way energy pulses from the deep storms in the Pacific and wraps and bends and hits the cobblestone floor and folds over on itself is perfect. Absolutely perfect. But really, the essence of Malibu is the beach. Just like Waikiki, where the beach boys got lusty in the sand, the sexed-up deviants. And Malibu's beach is even better than Waikiki. Surf historian Matt Warshaw writes, Malibu wasn't so much a surfing location as it was a small, intimate, well-designed surfing theater. And what a wordsmith, what a Linnaeus, and really, he probably should have finished with his PhD and gone on to do something valuable with his life, making his family proud in the process, but I'm glad he didn't. His shallow turn makes me feel slightly better about my own. The hook of sand that hugs the perfect wave is also the perfect size. Not too big, not too small. Not too near, not too far. Not too hot, not too cold. The wave breaking within spitting distance, that perfect wave, which pushed surfboard design and physical ability into the future. But the beach. The beach became a petri dish. Those who congregated here were already rebelling against the heavy cultural push to settle down and make a family. There's no room for a career when days are spent idling on the beach. The boys had been to war, and now they were on a beach, sun shining, waves peeling, and they were never going to leave. They were surfers. Up until Malibu in the 1950s, surf had always been married to some other physical expression in order to give it value. It was tied to rowing, life-saving, long-distance paddling, swimming. You did those other things and also surfed, and surfing was completely secondary. The post-war boys, though, stripped away the clunky extremities. They needed nothing other than surfing, and needed nothing else, full stop. Besides trouble, adrenaline, sex, drugs, and booze. Living on the beach is free. Waves are free. The sun is free, and surfing is free, and also impossible to fit into a normal life anyway. But it was this version of surfing, this rebellion, this addictive consumption that began mirroring its lover cocaine closer, maybe than it ever had before, even as cocaine itself was slipping further and further into the recesses of history. The Malibu crowd was a teeming mess of fuck-ups, man-boys with names like Tubesteak and Decat. They ran the beach like a gutter-snipe fiefdom. There were no rules other than the ones they made. No police, no lifeguards, no parents, no authority. They did what they wanted, how they wanted. And by the mid-1950s, this freedom was starting to draw. Malibu was getting flooded with urban kids fleeing the new American cult of conformity. But surfing always only belongs to a few, and these newcomers. And the man boys were mean sons of bitches to these newcomers. Their worldview was us versus them, and they would steal, cajole, play pranks, yell, swear, drink, 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 and surf, and surf, and surf. The surfers before had been rebels, but not like this new batch. And I think it was precisely because they had set surfing free, like cocaine freed from the leaf, surfing freed from rowing, life-saving, long-distance paddling, and swimming, became potent, addicting on a whole new scale, churning out junkies who acted like junkies. Surfers of today can look back on these 1950s Malibu surfers and see founding fathers, but they were assholes. Shallow, narcissistic, selfish assholes. And doesn't that just sound familiar? Doesn't that just feel like Teddy's circa 2001, and the Roosevelt circa two nights ago, and the agenda circa right now? The Octopus Boys and I have been joined by a rep for Fox, a motorcycle brand that also does surf trunks, hoodies, and t-shirts for some unknown reason. He's wearing a flat-brimmed hat slightly off-center, a Rob Dyrdek DC shirt, black shorts, white socks pulled up to his knees, and a pair of puffy-tongued circa shoes, mocking the mid-1990s Inland Empire aesthetic. His send-up is so subtle that only the most tuned in would know that he's actively poking fun of his brand's only customer. As self-destructively rebellious as starting a surf traction company in this economic environment. He's a jittery mess right now because he just got texted that Trestles is pumping and not too crowded, since the entire surf industry is sitting inside the Long Beach Convention Center. Fuck. Should I bail? What if I bail? He keeps uttering as he paces back and forth in front of us in his costume. Fuck. I'll get totally fired if I bail, but fuck. Jimmy Kane said it was solid 4 foot, and like, fuck, I'm crowded. Trestles, just south of San Clemente, is modern-day Malibu. It's California's high-performance modern heart, with the emphasis on high, because this right here is what untethered surfing leads to. This. Pacing, ranting, edgy, chatty, perpetually unfulfilled, always hunting. It is an infection. A proper addiction, beginning with that first proper wave. I actually remember mine. I was in Oregon, and I was 14, and Julie Briggs had just broken up with me via note slid through the metal slats on my locker. She was smart and going places. I was a surfer, because I loved what it meant, what it stood for, even though I'd spent the last 4 years barely standing in the whitewash. But Julie Briggs slipped a note in my locker telling me this wasn't going to work because I was dumb and going nowhere in my life, and dumb because I wore pirate surf shorts and TNC t-shirts to Marshfield High School every day, even though it was always cold and always raining. I ran all the way home, threw my goofy yellowed 7-foot pintail surfboard in my mom's grabber blue Ford Falcon, and she drove me to Bastendorf Beach, and I put on my wetsuits and caught a real wave. I mean, real wave. It was some freezing cold reform that had hit a weird sandbar and was actually working, for the first time in accidental history, down the line. Not closing out in typical fashion, and maybe as tall as my 5-foot head. I put on my hideous diving wetsuit over my holy 3-year-old other wetsuit, paddled out wanting to die because Julie Briggs had just broken up with me. Julie Briggs. Red-headed and smart, and on her way to an all-girls college. And I caught one, and actually accidentally turned, because I no longer feared death, and actually accidentally raced down the line. Raced down that open wave face, a little up, a little down, and was flooded with a sensation that I had never been flooded with before, and have never been flooded with in quite the same way again. Where had this been my whole life? And so long, Julie Briggs. This first sensation lasted exactly 3 minutes, and I needed it again. I stayed out in the freezing cold water until the sun went down, my mom shivering on the beach, wondering what the hell had come over me. But surfing had come over me. The addiction. And here's the thing, and only a thing that surfers will actually know. The feeling you get from that first wave is the worst thing that ever happens because it's heaven, and you chase it forever without replicating. I remember this first wave, but I remember none after, because the sensation of surfing lasts only as long as the wave does, and then you're stuck, and then you're chasing it forever from hit to hit, to get my nose in the fun dip. Cocaine might have been a semi-benign historical footnote through the 1950s, but it sure feels to me like surfing kept cocaine alive. It replicated its love's mannerisms, the beat of its heart, until the 1960s flipped the entire world on its head and demanded cocaine's return, her triumphant re-entry. And it was surfers who were there on the ground floor. Fox decides to bail to surf Trestles. I watch him scamper through the crowd in his 909 costume and chuckle with the rest of the Octopus Boys before we turn our attention to the disaster that is Modem. They just made an anti-shark leash in cooperation with anti-shark company Shark Bands that apparently shoots out a radio signal or something that confuses the sharks into not biting. A boy in Florida just got bit while wearing the same technology. Like, his arm almost got bitten off. He was wearing the bracelet version of Shark Band's technology that he got for Christmas. And it shouldn't be funny, but totally is. The conversation swings from modem to the upcoming U.S. Open of Surfing to a funny Hawaiian man who had just lost an arm while driving a car because he had it sticking out the window, and it seems as good a time as any to shift back to cocaine, so I say, "Let me hear your best stories." And they all smile, coy smiles, but no one offers any up. I just transitioned into that fucking surf journalist in their eyes, the fucking dick that everyone hates. Fucking hell. It's one of the things that drives me the craziest about this ill-begotten life. Surfers think they're the most important people on the planet for some completely unknown reason. Languish under the completely mistaken impression that the entire world is just waiting to hear their deepest, darkest secrets. That the entire world is going to lap up my sordid tales of their gilded lives. I know, for a welcome to paradise, now go to hell fact, that this is not true. Nobody, and I mean literally nobody, gives two shits. The bad stories, the naughty stories, are the only ones worth sharing anyhow. Keith Richards isn't shy about his cocaine use. It's what makes him Keith Richards, for crying out loud. So why are surfers so button-lipped about the only thing that makes them remotely interesting? Chapter 8. Finding Love in the Underworld. I leave Agenda before lunch because I'm angry. Also, because I don't want to have anything to do with the inevitable taco truck plus Corona Light thing that's bound to happen. But I'm mostly angry. Fuck surfers. Fuck their deviant yet chicken shit hearts. Fuck their shirking historical greatness. Fuck their silence. And why are they silent? Why don't they all profess their love from the rooftops? Why don't they belt sonnets? If surfers really accept who they are, deep in their hearts, I have no doubt in mind that the surf industry would come roaring back, that the kids would want Volcom and Quicksilver and Billabong and Reef once again. Not because the hang tags would be fitted with little cocaine baggies, but because the love story is true and truth resonates. But I have never in all my days seen one good representation of surfers and cocaine. And then I suddenly remember. Sea of Darkness, a phantom documentary about cocaine and the surf industry, a mirage that detailed a rarely discussed chapter of our history. I met its maker, Michael Oblowitz, almost a decade ago on Oahu. He'd been a myth before that, a man who had dared make a movie about the surf industry's direct connection to cocaine and heroin with real surf industry folk. CEOs of companies, brand managers, marketing directors, etc., actually talking on film about it. I didn't believe it. There was no way. The surf industry, the conservative, SIF, so Orange County scrubbed Disney NFL, tight, paranoid surf industry, actually copped to it all? So I tracked him down on the North Shore when I was writing my first godforsaken book. He sat me on the moldy bed of the musty surf shack he was renting while the surf crashed loudly outside, stuck a VHS tape in a machine, turned the volume up way too loud, and pressed play. And Sea of Darkness was the best surf movie I had ever seen. I wrote in that first surf book, "It's about the discovery of G-Land by the surfers, and the cocaine, and the heroin, and the jails, and later, the founding of Quicksilver. But he only screens it at small festivals and for people he knows. He says it's too heavy to release, too dangerous. He's worried about the blowback from the industry, and more importantly, from Hawaiian locals who were, are, involved in the drug trade, and he may be right to be completely paranoid. He's from South Africa and used to make vampire softcore porn for Showtime." Looking back, my description lacked grace, and also, I don't think he was or is worried about industry blowback or Hawaiian local blowback, though almost a decade later, Sea of Darkness is still unreleased. Michael told me after the book had come out, "Well, I was paranoid when you were there because I'd just done so much coke, like a ridiculous amount. I'm not afraid of the industry. But why, then, has it not been released more than a decade after being made? Is there some deeper reason for surfer silence? Something else the powers are trying to hide, besides a pretty good time? Thankfully, and maybe not coincidentally, I learned where his office is just a few weeks ago from a handsome French Moroccan. And so I get in my car and drive from Long Beach to Venice, listening to NPR until it transitions to a story about the rise of artificial intelligence being met with mixed reactions at South by Southwest. I switch to the Chainsmokers' new song and bop along like a teenage girl until I magically find a parking space off Abbot Kinney. While I feed the meter, a bum yells in my ear about needing $5 because he just got out of jail and has to get a bus ticket from Venice so he can get to Riverside or Corona or Chino or wherever and visit his grandmother at a nursing home. Every bum in Southern California uses a version of the same story. Like some bum screenwriter gave each of them a surefire narrative to spin for fundraising. A very modern, totally now hero's journey featuring $5, jail, the Inland Empire, and a grandma. To be honest, it's more compelling than Joseph Campbell's work, but only because it's devoid of ego, yet filled with over-the-top bravado. Each bum embraces the role wholly, bringing himself to tears as he talks about both jail and grandma and smiling at how easy it will be for him to solve his problem. Just $5. I give him $1. He asks, "Got any cigarettes?" When I shake my head, he peels off to perform Act 1, Scene 1 for an Asian man with a lanyard around his neck. And Venice. Fucking Venice. If Malibu was the exact spot on Earth where ancient surfing became modern surfing, then Venice is the exact spot on Earth where modern surfing becomes unrecognizable, and it has nothing to do with the bum. His knockoff mythology is the best part of this damned place. Google is the worst part. The web company moved an office here a few years ago into a Frank Gehry-designed thing with huge binoculars out front, which might not be the best icon for a group that's sometimes accused of peeking through our digital windows. It's all the surfboards lined up against a ruddy wall that really bothers me, though. Soft tops of various shape and length. Yellowed longboards. Stubby plastic things that only look like surfboards but would never be able to catch a wave. It's like they want their lanyarded employees to paddle out during lunch and make a mockery of the sport of kings and noble Peruvian fishermen. Like they want them to take their pale flesh out into the already very lackluster surf and paddle around with surfboard noses sticking straight in the air and arms and legs wailing uncontrollable and giggling. Like they are purposefully and carefully trying to drain the last vestiges of romance from anything related to wave riding. Or maybe the inertia is the worst. The exercise diet mountain sport website has its offices adjacent to Venice proper and also covers surf since its founder and editor was once the web editor at Surfer. Apparently, he thought what was missing from the surf media landscape was a Huffington Post-esque point-of-viewless take on everything from Chevrolet's new Bolt EV might be the perfect eco-friendly vehicle for surfers to, "I confess I'm a high-performance longboarder." And this bullshit purposefully and carefully tries to drain the last vestiges of edge, of danger, of sin, of degradation from anything related to surf journalism. To try and bring some sort of ecological, health-conscious meaning to the utter pointlessness. To maim even more profoundly than any Google employee flopping in Venice's shore break ever could, or at least to maim me. But right now, I don't care. I need to find Michael Oblowitz's office and wander up and down past food trucks and short-sleeved polo tech workers until I remember that his office is in Santa Monica, not Venice. Damn navigational amnesia. And go back to my car, this time giving a homeless grandma $1, thereby cutting the entire arc out of the hero's journey. I find his